Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
Together,
we're bloggingheads.tv.
You know, one day we'll get that right and smooth.
We are not ready to be the next choir, that's for sure.
Yeah, we didn't say prime. We're ready for prime time. And, of course, most people probably watch bloggingheads TV in non-prime time hours. In their pajamas, at home, alone.
And alert bloggingheads.tv viewers may notice that I'm speaking to you, David, from a different background.
Which, of course, I can't see.
You can't see, but that's why I'm telling you about it. The New America Foundation has moved offices just a few blocks from here in D.C. And I have this Venetian blind background, but we're soon going to have our own studio here, so this is
stepping up. We'll say New America Foundation 20,000 times in block print behind
Oh
my goodness, I must go look at the New America Foundation site. I don't know why, but something is telling me to do that.
Exactly.
I think that's, I don't know, did Reagan start that?
Reagan did, with the Reagan, put the White House
prosperity,
thing behind
prosperity,
the...
Prosperity, 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 peace, peace,
well,
peace, whatever. It's really, I think, in modern political times, one of my least favorite, media developments.
Yeah, I think what Reagan did was put the little sort of molded White House oval logo behind the press secretary.
Yeah.
And then what you've noticed is that other people have done all the Pentagon did it, the State Department did it, and I now notice like the state of California has one for Governor Schwarzenegger or Governor whoever. So I think the idea
it has
of
a fist in it, right?
of branding the location where you're at is seen as valuable.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about too now is they started doing those, and I think maybe the second Bush did it the most. They started, not just putting the White House, whatever, but these little buzzwords behind you.
Oh, right.
Healthy environment, clean
prosperity,
clean air, clean air, clean air. And I think, it's much overused, but I think Orwell would have gotten a big kick out of that.
And it doesn't seem to have convinced you in any case.
But every once in a while, when I think of George W. Bush, I think of prosperity, prosperity, prosperity. Which reminds me, we want to talk about Barack Obama. Before we do that, any thoughts on this? On the quick fade of George W. Bush? It seems to me no one's walking around these days saying, "Huh, I wonder what George Bush would be doing in this circumstance." I mean, you did say that when Bill Clinton left the White House. You did say that. Of course, he kind of stayed in our faces. But no one's really wondering, what should be WWWD? What would W do?
You're right. And, of course, at the big CPAC conference, it got all the attention with Rush Limbaugh and so on. Bush and, for that matter, Cheney weren't there. And with the exception of John Bolton, I can't think of any other Bush administration official who has even had any role at all, at least without a prominent
role. Which is hard to, because they don't have jobs. What else do they have to do? They should be roaming the halls. David Addington was reported there, doesn't have a job. Gonzalez still doesn't have a job. I mean, these guys, what are they going to do?
John, you have a job. I'm sort of amazed that he's working at UC, of all places, UC Berkeley, but I guess that
free
shows the
speech,
power of
tenure. Free speech movement, that's right, even for torturous speech, so to speak.
So have you read any of those memos, the John Yoo memos?
The ones that say the First Amendment is no match for the president in a time of war? Actually, once upon a time, co-author Mike Isikoff, did a lot of the news breaking work on that when they came out about a week ago. And you keep thinking that you couldn't be more, your breath couldn't be taken away more so than it has been with the memos and the rulings that have come out. But these did go much further. When he literally actually, I think that's close to an exact quote. The First Amendment is no match for the president in time of war, in which he really, believed in the paramount power of the executive. There is a legal, very small legal community that backs you up on this, but it really it's kind of I still think kind of stunning to me that a person taking such a distinctly minority position, would end up you know, just three or four people believing this can end up really sort of turning an entire ship of state in that direction. And at the White House press briefing after these memos came out, I believe Robert Gibbs was asked, you know, will we see more of these? And his general, I don't remember exactly what the answer was, but it was basically, heck yeah. I mean, I think Obama, you know, constitutional law professor that he once was, you know, certainly would enjoy seeing more of this made public.
Hmm. Well, as they say here in town, personnel is policy. And so if you get a certain person in a job, they can have, they, he or she can have a lot of impact, as you know, for better or for worse.
Right.
Anyway, but that's okay. So you're right. But meanwhile, right.
So
I've never met a Republican who says, if only we could get George W. Bush back. That is not a phrase I've heard yet. Although, I must say that President Obama seems to be encouraging anti-Obama thoughts, even inside the Democratic Party, if you read both the Washington Post and the New York Times this morning, Tuesday.
Yes, well, what's happening is that senators, mainly senators, and some of the, you know, the bull elephants, meaning, you know, the old-time chairman of the Democratic Party, are, you know, beginning to exert their constitutionally provided, we should say, prerogatives. And in the past, this has happened to other presidents. You might recall that when Bill Clinton came in, several leading Democrats in the Senate, gave him a hard time on his budget. And Senator Bob Kerry, at the time, famously refused to support it. He, of course, had run against Clinton in the primaries and had lost to him, so there seemed to be an element of resentment here, and refused to support his budget. And I think the day of or the day before the big vote on it, you know, he went off to Union Station to watch a movie and sort of get away from the cameras and the attention. He ended up voting for it in the end, but I think David Boren and a few other conservative Democrats did not and nearly sunk it. I think in the Bush years, particularly George W. Bush years, particularly after 9/11, there was a lot more deference paid within the Republican Party and Congress to the White House, and there was concern amongst. I mean, I'm hearing Trent Lott and others talk about this, even as they did it, that they were giving up some of their constitutional prerogatives to be an independent third branch, a check on the White House, even if the president is a member of your own party. So what we're seeing now is some Democrats coming forward and saying they don't like this about the budget and they want this earmark, that earmark. And I don't think Barack Obama and the people around him, say Rahm Emanuel, are surprised by this. So I don't think we should be at all. They're going to have to sort of, you know, deal with the powers that be, while at the same time trying to put pressure on them and try to, you know, reform the ways of Washington so that these prerogatives perhaps are less obstructionistic.
But you would agree that it makes an unpalatable picture to the country?
I still think the country is paying more attention to, you know, what's happening on the paychecks than what's happening on the front page of the Post. And, you know, Obama's numbers still are pretty high, and he still commands, you know, a pretty, vibrant bully pulpit. It's good for political reporting, and I will say this. I do think that it's a job of political reporters, I know this from being one, to find whatever conflict you can and to somewhat pump it up a bit. I don't think people make up stories. But, if you read the Washington Post story closely today, it noted things that could become clashes between the White House and Congress. You know, items in the budget that might cause conflict. You know, so there are a few things that have already, but it was also like saying, well, here are all the possible pitfalls ahead. We don't know.
Or items that might just disappear. I mean, yeah. For example, I suspect that the cap on agricultural subsidies is going to disappear.
Which would be a fully bipartisan endeavor in terms on Congress.
Right.
That's not
right.
It. You have, you know, it's, It's a cliche.
Pat Cochran and Byron Dorgan agree that there should be unlimited subsidies to corporate farmers. Pat Cochran, Republican of Mississippi, Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota.
I mean, it's a cliche, but so much of what happens in Congress is more determined by geography than it is by party affiliation.
And committee chairmanships. Will the chairman of the Finance Committee agree to see a cap on the charitable interest rate
deduction? Max Baucus, who has shown, much to the irritation of Democrats, an independent streak, a conservative independent streak in years past. And at the same time, this all gets rather complicated. We have a complicated system. That's what the framers delivered to us years back. It gets complicated because, the White House has to work with Max Baucus very closely, of course, on health care reform and a number of other major issues. And then if he has a pet issue about, deductions for charitable contributions, and, leaving aside whether, who's wrong or who's right on this, it's hard, to ask him to put forward your big, initiative in healthcare reform, and then and fight him on something else. So it's very unwieldy. And what we're seeing, what's really quite stunning, and I think about the Obama presidency so far. I think we're in week 7 or whatever it is that I think some other presidents in this position that he's in might be spooked. There are a million and one different crises out there. There's some things that you have to attend to literally on a day-to-day basis, bailing out, whether or not you're going to bail out AIG and other banks, and trying to do something about this accelerating, what seems to be accelerating, shedding of jobs in the U.S. economy. But on top of all that, he's now coming forward with healthcare reform, with education policy, which we can talk about later, which he announced in a big speech today being Tuesday. And, it's what Rahm Emanuel said, I think, after the election. A crisis can be an opportunity. So the agenda is much wider and more elaborate than most presidents would have in a time of prosperity.
Right. The precise quote was from Emanuel, and I don't know if this has ever been directly attributed to him. Maybe a better reporter like you would know. Did Rahm Emanuel, he's certainly been cited a million times as saying, quote, never waste a crisis.
Never let a crisis go to waste something.
Never let a crisis go to waste. Okay, if that's an established, bona fide quote from him.
But whether it is or it isn't, that does seem to be, one can look at that, pejoratively or not pejoratively, but it does seem to be their strategy here. And Obama's bringing forward a more elaborate, more complicated, more extensive, a wider agenda than we've seen from any other president. Part of it is what he has to do to respond to the crises, and then what he wants to do to sort of put the country, according in his terms, on a better path. And so that just, really, adds a lot to the plate in terms of the relationship between the White House and Congress.
Right, but wouldn't it seem, I don't disagree with anything you said, that the...
We're going to lose our audience share.
But here's the point, though. I think you can divide the Obama domestic agenda into sort of three categories. One is sort of budget fights, like we've been talking about before with Senator Baucus and Senator Dorgan and so on, which is all well within the Madisonian-derived constitutional check and balance, advise and consent nature of the government.
Right.
The president wants this, and the Congress wants that. The president proposes, Congress disposes. And I agree, that has consumed, because of the inherent drama in there, Peter Orszag calls for this savings or this increase, and the Congress says no. Political reporters can get their heads around that pretty easily.
Yeah.
And then there's a second category, which I think is where the real hearts of the Obama people are, because I think they're pretty much willing to let Congress have its head on spending issues, earmarks, that kind of stuff. Where the Obamans clearly, I think, are focus themselves is on long-term stuff like cap and trade, healthcare, and maybe clean energy, although you haven't really seen much on that so far.
And education.
But then there's sort of the common thread there is that the benefits, such as they are, will most likely be many years ahead. Meanwhile, and I think this is the serious and somewhat damning point here, is that the crisis right in front of us is the banking crisis, and I think it's fair to say that we have a completely feckless Treasury Secretary who can't make a decision and can't do anything, and is sitting there twiddling his thumbs, or I'm sure he's in a state of high agitation, when you read in the Washington Post, thanks to the good work of Subcommittee Chairman Kucinich, that AIG and Citigroup and J.P. Morgan all invested a total of tens of billions of dollars in foreign countries, China, Dubai, and mm-hmm. India, with money from the bailout.
Yeah.
Now, how can that be good for America? How can that be good for jobs? How can anybody look at Treasury Secretary Geithner and say, oh, yeah, job well done, guy. You've given money to these banks, and they're investing it in foreign countries.
Well, I think the money that they used didn't come from Geithner. That was Hank Paulson's money.
But when was the deal struck, though? When was the deal made?
Well, I couldn't tell you.
But I couldn't either.
But Obama, they've given, I think since Obama's come to office, they've given money, obviously, to AIG. There was a big payout, $30 billion or so, a week or so back. I'm not sure how much money is flowing. But anyway, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I do think, I've talked to people at Treasury, and to the few people working there at this point in time, because it's not fully staffed up. And, they are, like it or not, doing more than twiddling their thumbs. They are trying to deal with this. They came up with a housing mortgage issue. Their plan initiative. They're dealing with the auto company stuff as well. And I think they're trying to come up with re-regulation and their banking plan. They're still working on.
Paul Krugman said they're quote dithering unquote. Do you agree or disagree?
I would like to have seen them move faster and more forceful. I'm not sure they have the manpower, and part of this comes down to, trying to staff up. I mean, it's a serious problem. And I think there's an appointment issue here too. It's hard to get some of these people through for I think good reasons, but I think we pay the cost too. But by and large, that is, that is an issue. You've divided the issues I think up nicely here. There's the here and now. There's the long-term stuff that you got to get going on quickly. And then there's the back and forth,
Now, I said it's a political soap opera, a congressional soap opera, the long-term stuff. And then the thing which is just, we agree, is damaging the country badly every day, which is banks not lending,
AIG
being a black hole.
Yeah, but we also saw when Hank Paulson rushed to deal with that quickly, mm-hmm. It cost us, you and I, and our fellow citizens, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right. I mean, I oppose the Hank Paulson bailout.
But
I'm saying
the money that was spent when he wasn't dithering ended up being completely wasted. I mean, I'd like to see if these guys. I mean, actually at the time, I remember writing at the time. Wait a second. We shouldn't rush into this. There was all the from Wall Street and from others saying if you don't do this right away, we could have a total collapse. While that was always a theoretical possibility, I said that's not a reason for wasting hundreds of billions of dollars before we have an idea collectively what's the best way, what might be the best way to spend that money to save the economy. So to one degree, I don't want them to rush, but I don't want them to dither. I think it's kind of hard to figure out, well, what's the right balance in between here.
Right. I think that but meanwhile, the Obama people never seem to get tired of launching vast new initiatives, education today. I mean, it would appear that they are focused on more than one thing, and I think that will most likely prove to be a mistake of cosmic consequences for the country and for the Obama administration.
Well, it might.
When President Roosevelt had to deal with the financial economic crisis of 1933, everything that he did in the New Deal, whether you like it or not, whether it was the bank holiday or taking the country off the gold standard or creating the various public jobs programs, was oriented towards dealing with the Depression. And so why Obama would take time away to start talking about cap and trade and a
Well, actually, Jim, I mean, if you don't start on that right away, the scientific consensus is that we're about 10 years behind. And actually, the guy you worked for, you know, the first president, Bush, you know, sort of got it right when he set up standards back in the in the late 80s to get a regime in place ready by within 10 years. So,
but that was, well, he didn't really mean it, of course.
Of course.
He
worked for a lawyer.
No, it's just that the political pressure to do, quote, something was enormous. And
okay, so he just misled the us and it ended up wasting a decade or two.
Right. Look, I think this whole, I mean, it's getting, in case you haven't noticed, it's getting colder out there. And across the planet.
I mean, Jim, don't get into this argument with me, okay?
Well, I mean, if you want to argue against the scientific
consensus, feel free. But, you know, when you make a prudent decision,
which I think is deeply politicized. And then there's a second issue is what to do about it. Especially if it would appear something that Al Gore didn't think about, which is, hey, what if the sunspots stop, and in fact solar radiation to the Earth decreases dramatically, as has happened?
What if aliens come and tell us how fuel out of air?
But the point is, it's happened. The sun is cooling us right now.
You can't argue that the prudent thing to do is to go by the scientific consensus. You can play what ifs all you like, but if the solar flares increase, then there is an undeniable scientific consensus about what's happening with the atmosphere and also what needs to be done to redress it. You want to be a contrarian on this point, go ahead, but then you have to admit that you're just rolling the dice on a crapshoot based on nothing but a what if?
Well, no. I mean,
I'm basing the
quote "roll the dice" on the fact it's getting the O's were colder than the 90s. That's a fact. And in other words, it would seem kind of foolish to squander trillions of dollars and allow the U.S. economy to fold in the name of something that's not even happening. That's bad science, surely.
It is happening. The scientists. I encourage all blogging heads viewers to go to the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, website. They put out a report every few months assessing the science and telling people why they think it's happening and what should be done. The National Academy of Sciences does this too. They present the data. What's going up? What's happening with the polar ice caps, with ocean temperatures, with atmospheric temperatures, surface level temperatures? Read for yourself, okay?
Okay, I will encourage Blogging Heads fans to go look up the information by a fellow named Benny Pieser, P-E-I-S-E-R, of the somewhat obscure Liverpool John Moores College in, of all places, Liverpool, England, who has been tirelessly accumulating evidence mostly on the political economic costs of this action and the absolute collapse of support for this in the European Union, to say nothing of the completely non-existent support for this in Russia, China, etc. And so if you're left in a situation, David, where the U.S. cuts its own throat while the rest of the world happily continues to pump out CO2, so we're left bankrupt, the world fills up with CO2, and then, by the way, it's still getting colder because the sun is in a non-sunspot phase right now.
Listen, the European Union signed on to Kyoto, and they will sign on to Copenhagen, and everything's open to negotiations with the other nations as well, but certainly if we don't do anything, nobody else major will as well. Okay.
And meanwhile, the U.S. GDP is falling, and I just submit to you.
No thanks to our carbon-dominated economy.
Pardon?
No thanks to our carbon-dominated economy.
Well, the question is, if you shut down our carbon-dominated economy, what happens then? Are we better off?
Well, actually, we might be if we move to green technology and become
leaders. We better replace it with something.
Because we're losing all those manufacturing jobs now. They're not going to be coming back. We got to start making something else. Maybe green energy and technology will give us at least a momentary edge in this globalized world of ours.
I
Because we don't, because we have no, because we don't have anything else. We don't have cars. We've lost semiconductors, you know, and now the whole service economy is being outsourced to India.
That would be a good candidate for President Obama or a good president to fix. I mean, what would be the harm in simply passing a rule that says if you want to sell something in the U.S., you got to make it here? What would be so bad about that?
I don't know. The unions sure like that.
I would. Yeah. I mean, I think the Hamiltonians would like that.
Well, okay.
I think the point is, I mean, you're right. If we don't have an industrial, if we don't have a manufacturing economy, if we don't have an added value economy, then we're in desperate trouble.
Yes, which is what's happening at the moment.
I agree. But the point is, chasing out what remains of industry to China, where they can happily
ignore. Well, then we also have to make sure, we have to make sure that Walmart only sells what's made in America, and that American consumers are ready to pay more.
Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That is the trade-off you make. But
which could be a good trade-off if people are willing to do it. But again, in these bad economic times, asking people to pay more for anything is going to be
difficult. If they have jobs, they could afford it. But I mean, meanwhile, the question is given the urgency of the economic situation, is President Obama wise to keep piling on lofty, visionary new things on top of the current situation?
Well, as he said in that speech he gave to Congress the other day, I mean, he answers your questions, but probably not to your satisfaction, I would gather, and explaining why all these things are actually part of, you know, the current crisis. And why?
Or could it just be that he's a liberal who just can't, who's got 30 years worth of liberalism to unload on America, and he can't wait, and therefore wants to, as Mickey Cowles says, stuff the beast.
Oh my goodness! Taking advantage of having won an election, that's never happened in American history.
No, it happens all the time.
Yes.
The question is he doing it in a wise way?
Well, you know what? We will see. The thing is, everything he's trying to do, whether it's the recovery package, whether it's his budget, whether it's health care reform, cap and trade will take longer to figure out because of, you know, what you're doing with a problem with a longer trend line, although I think it's an immediate problem. But education, again, may be harder to assess. But, you know, listen, all these things are, you know, contribute to the type of economy that we do have. But they all also, most of them, will be judgeable within a short framework. I mean, this guy's pretty much, you know, comes across as an adult. When he was asked at his first press conference, okay, you got this fancy schmancy stimulus package out there, how are we going to know it does any good? He said, in a year, see how many jobs we have. Listen, that's going to happen. Before the 2010 election, Republicans can be heartened at this point. There will be data. We'll know how many jobs we have. We'll know what the inflation rate is. We'll know what the unemployment rate is. And, you know, there will be an argument about the impact of his actions on whatever the situation is, because you can always say it would have been 15% instead of 10% had he not done this. You know, you can always make that sort of case. Or you could say, well, it would have been 8% instead of 10% if he hadn't done this, right? But nevertheless, the public will have a sense of where the economy is and whether things are moving, you know, more or less in a good direction or not. So if he wants to sort of, you know, he has public support now, we'll see what he can get through Congress, which is the big obstacle to any president, right? You know, Congress doesn't move fast. And there'll be plenty of time for you and your fellow Republicans to judge him.
Right. I would say right now, present trends continue, he's going to be a one-term president.
Yeah, but of course you said he wasn't going to be elected to begin with.
He was behind until
he would just be that
the meltdown.
That his real liberalness would be exposed, and he would have, you know, and he'd be rounded. Did you say 40 states? I think you said he wouldn't get more than 10 states.
If McCain had done the opposition research job on Obama that they should have done, I think that would have been the case. And if it had, and I did make those predictions prior to the economic.
Well, then you should be.
In the week after Palin spoke and before the meltdown, the McCain-Palin ticket was 2.5 points ahead, according to the polls.
Well,
for like a week and a half.
Yeah, but as we know, it didn't mean anything at the time. And that doesn't mean anything now, I should say. And reality has a way of intervening. And, you know, and whatever happens between now and 2012, there will be at least 3, if not 30, things that we have not foreseen that will have some impact on what happens in 2012. So, you know,
I'll give you one, by the way, Mr. Pinkerton. I'm sorry?
Make whatever prediction you like, Mr. Pinkerton. It really doesn't matter.
I just want to register, as an American worried about the economy, I want to register my concern that Obama seems to be too busy traveling to the Finland station to worry about the humdrum issues of what his idiotic Treasury Secretary has done. And that is my opinion on that. But having solved this issue, at least for as far as we're going to get in terms of solving it.
Let me ask you about something else on domestic policy, because we referred to it, but it's actually, since it's in the news this week, maybe it will boost ratings if we talk about it. And maybe like it's sweeps for policy wonks. That's education reform. Right. I've looked at the speech, I've looked at the White House fact sheet, and it seems to me, you know, Obama's line on this through the campaign and up and, you know, through his presidency now has been that, you know, we've been caught up in what he calls the stale debates of the past between throwing more money at the problem and, you know, instituting reforms that, you know, end up, you know, being opposed by the teachers' unions, more testing, less testing. And, you know, looking at what he's proposing, which is more investments in certain federal investments in public education, and of course I think the recovery package and money for school construction, but also, you know, expanding those education reforms that already exist in terms of merit pay for teachers and, you know, changing the procedures so it's easier to bounce and effective teachers, and testing. You know, he calls for, you know, smarter testing, not off-the-shelf testing, and the curriculums that just aren't geared just to testing but to critical thinking. It seems to me that he's actually trying to straddle one or two lines at once, but, you know, from my perspective, doing it in kind of a smart way.
When I hear things like not off-the-shelf testing, but testing, critical thinking testing, I think that sounds to me like
I didn't say critical thinking. There's two different things. Finding better testing while also having curriculum that looks at how to enhance critical thinking rather than just testing.
Enhance critical thinking. The C word there, critical, is the code word for whatever education fad wafts through the education community. They get to do, because we're quote encouraging critical thinking. I mean, I think the blunt reality of education is either you know the stuff or you don't. It would appear that the Chinese and the Indians and the Malaysians know their stuff. I think I read somewhere that there are 6 million Westinghouse scholars in China. 6 million. And if they have a country of 1.3 billion people, all of whom are producing children who are having higher SAT scores and, you know, than us, then we're in a lot of trouble long term. And anything that satisfies the National Education Association, the AFT, and the 100 other satellite groups that waters down the testing in the name of making people feel good about flunking the old test, I'm skeptical. Having said that, I think that the most interesting and compelling figure in American education today is Michelle Rhee, who is the chancellor, superintendent of the D.C. public schools, who is fighting the fight at the battle line where it is being fought now over merit pay, teacher tenure, and so on and so on. Even as charter schools proliferate here in the District of Columbia, I think I read somewhere that half the kids in D.C. now go to charter schools. And there's tremendous potential for abuse, and there has been tremendous abuse.
And the testing, but there's also testing issues in charter schools.
And there's testing. There's a million different issues, but it would appear that the debate on education has narrowed in a constructive way, as in we're honing in on a narrower set of issues that are worth arguing over, and that vouchers on the one side, and sort of this total give the unions whatever they want status quo on the other side has sort of evaporated as serious prospects. And so what we're left with is, can people like Michelle Rhee survive, because there's plenty of people who want to remove her from office here in D.C., and can education reformers like that, the Wendy Copps of the world, the Teach for America, all those sort of groups that are full of, and it's basically, I freely admit, a fight almost entirely within the Democratic Party.
I've been impressed with Obama's approach. I think he has, been willing to a degree. I'm not saying, his job isn't to blast or crush the teachers' unions, but to take them on, what I would say in a constructive manner.
I will say this, though, and that is that I really strongly doubt that the solution to American education is going to be found within the current gang of people. I suspect that the solution, if it comes, will come from outside. And I'll give you two potential outside forces. One is Google, and the other is a fellow named Stephen Wolfram, Wolfram, who is a computer scientist. He got a PhD in computer science from Caltech when he was 22 years old, back in the late 70s, and now has a new computational search engine called, temporarily, is Wolfram Alpha, that just got unveiled as sort of a beta in the last couple of days. And if, in fact, he can come up with something that genuinely figures out the answer, doesn't just search around looking for the answer, as does Google, and doesn't just pile up information, as does Wikipedia, then we've got the kind of quantum leap, sort of mind-blowing scientific breakthrough that will change everything the way we think about education, I think.
I with two kids in public elementary schools, I mean, to me, the answer is always the obvious one, and that is, the education is based on who's doing the teaching and the interaction that the children have with the teacher and with others in a setting that is somewhat conducive to learning. I mean, and for different kids, that's a different type of setting. And, if someone comes up with a technological fix to our education problem, I'm all for it. But I think, until that, comes across in what's in a practical to use manner, it seems to me that, nothing is more paramount than just getting high quality teachers. And to me, that's a question of both money and reform, which is why I like Obama's approach.
I agree. I think my point, though, is I suspect that you have smart kids, and I suspect that your kids are smart in large measure because you and your wife put a lot of effort into them and make resources and tools available to them way beyond the schools.
Their education is enhanced. But I mean, I do volunteer work in the class, and I do see kids without all these, without some of these advantages, doing well, and I see many not doing well.
I'm saying that's not the only chance they have.
The
additional chances they have would be some. I mean, Google is free to the user, and I believe that Wolfram Alpha is going to be free as well. I think that if we're dealing with an unbelievable crush of information and knowledge and in a wildly competitive environment around the world, all I'm saying is that the solution, the need is so enormous that the solution, happily, the solution I think is going to come from somewhere else. I don't minimize my parent. Both of my parents were teachers. I've benefited enormously from
explains your pedantic nature. Just kidding.
From public and private education, both. I went to public schools mostly as a kid, and so I'm just saying I do agree that Obama's education strategy is a reasonable one. Although again, I won't belabor the point anymore. I think that he's spending too much time on education and not enough time helping Tiny Tim Geithner figure out what to do about AIG, because that's the real fire right now. And if Obama helps the Michelle Reeves of the world, and I mean that in the plural, do their jobs better, that's great, but that payoff will come in 10 years, not 6 months. So, meanwhile, speaking of things that are happening right now, we should shift over to foreign policy before we run out of time here.
China... seamen, mooning American seamen. Is this? It's like There's always a foreign policy crisis in it, you know, early in her presidency. And I think, what was it around April in 2001 that we had this Chinese spy plane?
Yeah, Hainan Island thing.
Yeah. But I got to wonder, is this the best we can come up with? I mean, the Obama people have been pretty lucky up to now in that, you know, the Israelis, you know, halted, you know, so to speak, the, you know, that offensive assault or attack, whatever you want to call it, in Gaza prior to his inauguration. You know, Hillary Clinton's been traveling around the world and getting good reviews and, you know, dealing with Russians, whatever.
Well, but not some good reviews. I mean, some bad reviews, too. She's had trouble spelling.
Yeah, they misspelled reset in Russian. But, you know, it's a different alphabet. So, you know, I'm sure it's like, you know, trying to, you know, spell an Arab, you know, an Arabic word perhaps. But nevertheless, you know, he's had the privilege so far to not have to, you know, focus, you know, overly on any particular foreign policy crisis. That can't sustain itself, can it? I mean, at some point there's going to be something, right?
Right.
And so maybe now's the time to education, healthcare, stem cell research, because who knows what the Russians might do in Georgia, you know, come June.
Or the Iranians or the North Koreans or whoever's.
Right.
I mean, I must say that, you know, if the Chinese had Chinese intelligence ships, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 miles off our coast all over the place, I suspect there'd be incidents, too. You know, President Obama is doing something interesting, which is he is keeping, and in some cases expanding, the scope of American commitments while planning for a pretty substantial drawdown in defense spending. And so
we're not yet in the current budget. It goes up.
Well, but I mean, relative as a share of GDP, as a share of the budget, is going down over the next 10 years. And I mean, it's to the lowest level since the 1930s.
Well, one reason is that it just hasn't been sustainable. I mean,
I agree, but the point is, if you still then say we are going to closely monitor the Chinese and fight on in Afghanistan and keep 50,000 troops in Iraq, which is a pretty big number. To say that you're withdrawing from Iraq and still saying, but by the way, we have 50,000 troops here, and that's not withdrawal the way a lot of people would think of the word.
Right, and again, it depends whether they stay there for 10 years or 2 years, you know, in terms of, if you're looking just at cost figures, it makes makes a very big difference. I mean, Iraq, in some ways, he's been able to, de-emphasize. You know, he has his plan. Some Democrats want it to be faster, the drawdown than he says it's going to be. You know, my position is, as long as it's moving in the right direction, you know, whether it's 16 months or 19 months, I don't care. And a year and a half from now, we can argue whether we still need 50,000 troops at that point, or 20,000 or 10,000 or none. And maybe the Iraq government at some point will give us a polite invitation to leave, whereby there won't be any need for the debate. You know, what I've been following more closely and asking about at the White House press conferences is really about Afghanistan, which is where there are some very hard decisions to be made. I mean, he's announced already that he's going to send 17,000 new troops in the spring and summer, but at the same time, there is a policy review underway that's supposed to end by the end of this month. And one question I've had is why, you know, make the commitment to send troops before you know what they're going to do in terms of the policy review. But, you know, there are a lot of major questions for him to contend with, particularly what are our strategic and more, maybe even more difficultly to assess, what are our tactical goals in Afghanistan? We have a government there that President Obama has said is detached from the rest of the country. So, you know, what can we do? And, on top of the, you know, the Taliban problem, which bleeds over to the Al-Qaeda problem, which bleeds over into a possible Pakistan problem, there's also the drug problem. The President Bush, you know, made Afghanistan, set it up as a very noble mission to establish a Western-style democracy with a GDP to rival Italy's. Even though that's not as good as it used to be, within a couple of years. And that, you know, doesn't seem to be in the cards these days, particularly with our European allies. It seems, you know, less eager than ever to help us rebuild Afghanistan.
Right. I think, that as with Bush 41 and climate change, I think that President Obama said he was going to win in Afghanistan during the campaign, mostly because it gave him something to say as we're getting out of Iraq. But I don't really think they mean it, and I don't really think they have any real interest.
What would be a win? That's the thing.
Well, I think that's the point. I mean, what do you do in a country of 28 million people who are... I mean, I think that the real story of the, quote, Taliban is that they are ethnic Pashtuns who don't like the Americans and do like the Pakistanis, and the Pakistanis like them in return because they're the same ethnicity, and they don't like their fellow Afghans very much, and they're going to fight anybody who tries to impose a rule on them. And you can call it anything you want, but it's mostly just sort of an ongoing civil war that has been settled in the past over the centuries of Afghan history by sort of
fighting,
punctuated by
dividing.
Okay, by dividing by. Okay, you stay on your side of the line, and we'll stay on our side of the line.
Right.
I mean, it is kind of amazing to me that if somebody said, "Listen, the definition of victory is that there's a big chunk of American troops there in Afghanistan, and by the way, Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opium," and we'll sort of look the other way while that continues to happen. I mean, that is kind of astonishing how we let ourselves get talked into that. And again, the Afghan situation turned, which I originally supported back in 01 and 02, turned extremely south when President Bush turned his attention to Iraq and let things clearly get out of hand in Afghanistan. But I think now it's entirely questionable what positive good we're achieving there. We're not catching bin Laden, and we're not even catching Mullah Omar, and we're not really building a democracy. We're building sort of a, quote, stability, unquote, for a place that produces opium. And I think if I were a European country, I'd be wondering why this is worth anything at all in terms of...
Well, part of what Obama might have to do here in some ways is, and I think it's hard to do this overnight, is to change some of the expectations. You know, we talked about, definitions of, if not victory, definitions of success, which, you can even have benchmarks, so to speak, to use a cliched word here in Washington, that don't end up with ultimate victory and the creation of a highly industrialized, pro-democracy, Western-leaning, state within the borders of Afghanistan. And, I'm waiting to see whether this policy review, shows signs that's the direction they're heading. I imagine that shortly after.
Who's conducting it, by the way, just for fun?
Well, I mean, it's being done at the Pentagon, but I think the whole national security team is participating. But General McKiernan, who was head of the forces there, the U.S. forces there, is deeply involved in this. But I assume when it's done, too, will come a time shortly after that where Obama, whether through a speech or some forum, will have to sort of explain his Afghanistan policy. I mean, he does get questions on this. Well, I should say Gibbs gets questions on this in the press room. He was asked about this at his first and so far only press conference. I hope there are more. So it's not something that he can, I think, avoid talking about for too long once this review is conducted. It sort of lays a marker for him. So in the next...
Is there a timeline on the review?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the end of March. It was a 60-day...
Okay. All right, so that's pretty quick.
It was a 60-day review that started sometime... they called it 60 days. So, I mean, I don't think there's a date certain, so to speak, but there certainly, is a pretty specific time frame. So
that's something...
Mark down on your calendars, viewers. Big Obama statement on Afghanistan, end of March, beginning of April.
Now, a question for you on this, because I've been meaning to ask. Do you have you been following, of course you have, but for the benefit of our viewers who might not, the case of Chaz Freeman?
He's been picked to head the National Intelligence.
Has he been named, or just for you to read about him being named?
Usually it's not a big deal. Who runs the National Intelligence Council? The National Intelligence Council is made up of intelligence, analysts from all the various agencies. There are 13 intelligence agencies in what's called the intelligence community, or as I call it, the intelligence establishment. And they get together and they produce intelligence estimates, which people might be familiar with from back in the Iraq War days. And it's a pretty erudite body of folks that produce these estimates, and they argue points sometimes, and sometimes, you know, one agency will have some contention with another about a particular approach. But it's all, you know, it's all intelligence. It's not policy making. It's all about trying to come to terms, and sometimes predictions are involved, but they shy away from that, with what, you know, our intelligence agencies believe is happening on a given country or a given subject area. And of course, you know, the intelligence that a president gets supposed to help them create policy, although we often see in the past it has nothing to do with that. So Chaz Freeman, who's a longtime intelligence analyst, has been chosen. I don't know if it's if it's been officially announced or not, to head up what's called the NIC, the National Intelligence Council, and it's gotten some conservatives up in arms because, Jim?
Well, Chaz Freeman is also the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So he is sort of with an extensive.
He's
Middle
a foreign
East,
policy geek.
Right. Right. Although, again, and people get a name ambassador to Saudi Arabia, there's a heavy political oil company inherent in that. I mean, the foreign policy geeks get appointed ambassador to Marshall Islands.
There have been career ambassadors there. There's a guy named David Korn, not me, who was ambassador there, and I still get calls from him once in a while, who was just a career FSO.
But there's a certain, there's a political dimension.
It's a sensitive position.
That the word geek doesn't quite get at in terms of these guys, if they're named ambassadors. Anyway, Chaz Freeman, and if you just, the minimal Googling, let alone, you don't need Stephen Wolfram for this, will produce a cascade of criticism and support as well, but pro and con over this. So this is a major. I mean, we were saying before about how every president gets a foreign policy crisis, right. And President Bush, 43, got the Hainan Island crisis of the spring of 01, and Obama, 44, is getting, the Chinese
mooning
our sailors. And same thing with an early fight over intelligence. Jimmy Carter had the fight over Ted Sorensen. Early in Clinton's second term, we had the fight over Anthony Lake, and now Chaz Freeman is getting a big fight. If it's not even clear he's been named, for a guy who hasn't even, I don't think, officially been put forward, there is an enormous ruckus because of some comments he's made about Israel and about China, seen as too realist in the kind of Hans Morgenthau-ish kind of way. It's like, well,
you better explain that reference to those of us who are under 75 years of age.
Right. Hans Morgenthau, not to be confused with Henry Morgenthau, the Treasury Secretary, or his son or grandson, who was the New York District Attorney. Hans Morgenthau was a foreign policy savant, closely associated with the realist school of foreign policy. Henry Kissinger is sort of a Morgenthau type. Don't worry about their regimes, don't worry about their governments, just deal with them as the country as they are, right, and hope to get the best deal from them. And Freeman has seems to have a pretty strong dose of that in him, and it has caused a ruckus inside the intelligence, inside Washington.
The interesting thing is, if you Google this, you'll find a number. I mean, I'm on a couple of listservs that have obsessed over this particular dust up, and I've been impressed that on them that I've seen numbers of testimonials for Chaz Freeman coming from people who say outright that they have opposed him on every foreign policy matter that has come up in the last 20 years, just in terms of people attesting to his. To his intellect, and more importantly, this is what you want in this position, to his intellectual honesty. And it's been impressive to me that these people have come forward and have said, listen, this guy is a good pick, he has his own views, but it's not about, running the NIC isn't about putting forward your own views, but handling this unwieldy collection of foreign policy and intelligence analysts throughout the government and producing a product that is reflective and that gives the president the information he needs to make a decision.
Okay.
People who run NICS tend not to advise the president. They're not in the room. Those are for higher ups, the National Director of Intelligence and others.
Okay. Do you think he'll make it? Do you think he'll be installed in his job?
I think so. I mean, that's my guess. I don't think this has been right now sort of a page A12 story in terms of media coverage. There's a lot else happening now. I don't believe it's a position that has to go through the Senate. I have no doubt some senators will complain, but this is another instance where perhaps because there's so much happening at the moment, it may be harder for his opponents to get too big a head of steam.
And this is another example where personnel is policy, because he clearly represents a big change from the Bush 43 presidency.
My guess is that throughout the Bush 43 presidency, the position of the people with significant jobs in the National Intelligence Council were probably not in line with the Bush foreign policy philosophy.
They might have kept their heads down and figured this is.
Well, they might have produced what they produced, Dick Cheney and the White House said thank you very much. Next. This is not, I think, fair to say, having him in charge is not sort of a radical shift in terms of, what's happening within the institution.
But the optics of picking him are pretty radically shifting.
Of course, the optics of picking Shinseki and other things. There are a lot of actually, it's kind of difficult not to have radical optics when you move from the Bush-Cheney administration to anything else, particularly if it's reality-based. Whether it's stem cell research, whatever. I mean, it's, like John Yoo to, someone who actually, believes in the Constitution. Right now, this is not at DEFCON 1 yet. I'd say this is at DEFCON 4 in terms of Washington flare-ups. We'll see.
Has it come up with the Robert Gibbs briefings at all?
Yes. There was at least one question asked by it, and trying to recall now what was said. I mean, I can't remember the answer, which probably means Gibbs didn't really say anything much one way or the other. But it certainly, it wasn't, it was not, there was nothing that he said that would give one the impression that they were abandoning Chaz Freeman.
Okay. Well, and anyway, in the criminology, and I mean that with no imputation as...
Hey, CPAC, they're selling bumper stickers to say Barack Obama, USSA.
Using criminology in a completely neutral phrase studying who's... Where in the hierarchy, that will be an interesting one. Anyway, David, unless there's anything else, we should wrap up.
We'll save the movie talk for next time. I'm sure you have a lot to say about Watchmen.
Well, we'll have to tease them, won't we?
Yeah,
anyway,
leave them wanting more. That's the blogheads.tv philosophy. Okay, so let's say goodbye and click off.
All right, thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.